Welcome to Think Big for Africa podcast. On this podcast, we will bring you interesting conversations with local, national, and international African leaders from all walks of life, home and abroad. Leaders who are doing their bits to progress Africa's development. Conversation topics will range from education, science, health, leadership, politics, business, and many other global issues. Conversations about everything that concerns Africa's development. Africa has so many wonderful achievers worldwide, and this is exactly what we will bring to you on Think Big for Africa podcast. Stay tuned.
Good.
Let's get on. See, just, hey. My audience know who I am, so maybe it's left for you to tell them who you are. All right. Yes, guys. Today I have my good friend, a former colleague in banking. We are going to talk about so many interesting topics. You know, I haven't talked to him for a long time. We are on a forum where all former members of the bank are on, and he contributes some very interesting articles. You know, he's a writer. He's a very good writer, and the topics of the things he contributes are, I think, very interesting, and you guys might like to know. Okay, his name is Dennis Onakino. Dennis.
That's correct.
Yes. Dennis, how are you?
I'm fine.
Good. See, I just told my audience that you are a writer, a great writer. Okay, so. See, help me.
What a compliment.
Yes. Help me. Tell my audience what you do. Hey, and then we'll get to it. All right?
Okay. So, professionally, I would say I'm a banker. Having chucked in some 25 years of experience in banking.
Wow.
Beginning with the People's Bank of Nigeria, the different People's Bank set up under the Babangida administration, then to Citibank, later Citigroup, then to Access Bank. I left Access Bank 2013, and since then I've been into several endeavors ranging from mortgage to consulting for a private financial tech company.
Okay.
But now I try to put my hands in writing. I periodically contribute to one of Nigeria's fast rising online media, the News Guru.
Yeah.
Or maybe weekly or as the case may be, depending on the particular issue in question, I submit articles to them for publication. So
yeah.
Basically, people say I'm a writer, some say I'm a banker, but I don't see myself as such. I see myself as a historian, natural historian.
Okay. See, you know, it's interesting.
Yeah.
My father was a historian, okay? Even though he studied history and he taught history even to A-levels. Maybe this is why I'm very interested in European history, because that's what my father taught. So for me, I've been opportune to read European history from my teenage years. And today I have several books of European history. I have many, you know, and I love reading it because for me, it gives me a very good perspective of why Europe is how it is. Okay. And not only Europe, other countries who were formed by Europeans. Okay. Because they took their culture to these countries like the US, Australia, Canada. So, see, when I look at those countries, I go back and I understand how they got to where they are. And it's interesting. It's interesting. And yeah, I encourage everybody to read history. Okay. When you read your own history, when you read it, then you know and you understand exactly why and where you are. You know, so that's it.
As Bob Marley would say, if you know your history, you know where you're coming from.
Yeah, yeah. you know where you're coming from and why you are where you are. Yes. See, we were talking last week and we talked a little bit about traffic. You see, it's something I really want to talk about, you know. Traffic in Lagos. Yes. And we talk about something specific about the traffic situation in Lagos Island, okay? Because and we talk about the fact that there's only one road going into from Lagos Victoria Island to Lekki to all the way to Ajah.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I grew up in mainland, and I know every street in mainland, there are multiple routes to enter and go out. Okay. So me, it will be very difficult for me to live in the island, okay, because I see a big risk if something happens, there's no way to exit, everybody will be running to the same place, and the whole place will be blocked like it is almost every day. I mean, hey, you live there, so tell us what happens there.
Okay, I live on the Lekki Ajah Badori axis.
Okay.
Badori is actually the almost the end of the Lekki Peninsula. So and like you rightly observed, when from Victoria Island going into Lekki Ajah is one way.
Yeah.
There's been an attempt to create alternative routes, but the alternative routes serves little or no useful purpose because
why?
Once the main highway is blocked, it's as good as the alternative route, which you can see, is also blocked. So it's a problem. But I will tell you that the traffic situation, like you said, is part of the Nigerian leadership conundrum, the Nigerian leadership problem.
Okay.
You can't extricate it from that. Why do I say that? The development or the fiscal development of the Lekki Ajah Badori axis, so to say, is not a properly planned phenomenon.
Yeah.
I use that. Unlike the mainland where the colonial masters built. You know, we mustn't forget that the Lagos mainland comprising places like Yaba, Ikeja,
Ebutometa,
where the places inhabited by the colonial masters primarily when they were ruling Nigeria. So you have those places properly planned, but unlike those areas now, the new areas coming up, the Lagos suburbs, which are not part of the Lagos conurbation,
yeah,
are not planned in any way, are not physically planned, so to say. Mm. So what you have is different individuals or groups coming together to carve out a specific enclave for themselves, build an estate, and the estate doesn't link, they don't link one another. Neither do are there adjoining roads linking one another. So once you have a problem on the main road leading into that area, is a gridlock, and the gridlock remains.
Well, see, for me, the same issue. Well, the main road. Let me give you this. In the 1990s, my parents left Bariga, where we used to live, and they built their own house in Alagbado, close to AIT. Okay, in fact, the workers of AIT used to pass our house every morning and come back past our house. Okay, in those days, but that area is okay. The main road is mainly one road to Otta, but then it has so many tributaries to come in and go out. Okay. There are so many. Okay, so within a mile or 1 kilometer, you find one way, one exit or entry. Okay, yes. There is a main road all the way from Oshodi towards Otta. But then you can always come in and go out from different areas. And from AIT place, you might even decide not to go back to main road. You might take one other way to Otta or to what's it called? What's the name of this place? Well,
okay, that's going towards Ogun State.
Yes, or coming back to Ikeja. There are so many ways. Okay, so this phenomenon is mainly in that island access, and the thing is that when you look at the people who live there, as they are supposed to be some of the wealthiest people in Lagos. That live on the island, and they're living in a place where there is no exit for them to come out of if, God forbid, something disastrous happens. It's scary and it's nonsensical for people like this to go in that place, live there without having any exit strategies.
Now, I can understand your point very well. And I think I want to say what you've just said is the issue of reckless individualism. the issue of reckless individualism that now signposts the, what I call the decline of values in Nigeria, where when nothing works, when nothing that is a social service that the government is supposed to provide, when it doesn't work, an individual being rich enough provides this for himself. They call it a stage in capitalism, a stage in decline in the capitalism of a third world country, or rather a peripheral capitalist country in academic term. You see, now look at it this way. You can take it holistically. There's no water in Nigeria.
Yes.
Everybody knows that. There's no pipe bomb. I grew up with pipe bomb water provided by the colonial masters.
Me too. I lived some time in Festac when I was very young, and there was water. In fact, the road
now.
Yeah.
It doesn't work any longer because either the pipes have been dug up under the guise of grading the road and all that. So what happens now? An individual builds a house and provides his own water. He digs a borehole
and
he has water in his house, an individual affair.
Yeah.
So it goes on and on. So there is no concerted effort to ensure that the general public has pipe-borne water.
Yeah.
So pipe-borne water is like, how do I put it now? Like pipe-borne water is alien to a little child born today.
Yeah.
What he sees is water running in his house, provided by a borehole sunk in his, sunk in his house.
In fact,
so the same goes with electricity.
Yeah.
Electricity now is now being provided by individuals through solar panels and all that, generator that billows suit into the air.
Yeah.
So you don't really, everybody is gradually moving away from the public electricity, which is so epileptic that you cannot even rely on it.
Yeah.
As we're talking now, my gen is powered so that my equipment doesn't go down. So that is the problem you also see with roads.
Yeah.
It's just that an individual cannot build a road that will link to his destination. Otherwise, that is what you would have seen. So the issue of traffic is endemic and it's going to continue. There is no, there seems to be no, it still boils down to the issue of drainage.
Yeah.
Drainage in the area, sewage disposal in the area. All these things are interconnected. They are part of the Nigerian leadership crisis.
They are. They are.
And so when you look at it, you can't separate one from the other. As the leadership crisis exacerbates, so all this problem also exacerbate. There is no, you can't treat this one without address until you address the leadership problem in Nigeria. Every other thing, nothing will work. You know, Achebe, Chinua Achebe.
Yeah, sure.
Said this thing way back in 1984. In his The Trouble with Nigeria.
Okay.
There's a pamphlet, a small pamphlet. He wrote The Trouble with Nigeria. What he said? That the problem of Nigeria is simply and squarely a problem of leadership.
Okay.
Simply and squarely. Those were his terms. There's nothing wrong with the Nigerian character, nothing wrong with the Nigerian air, nothing wrong with the Nigerian environment. But the problem is simply and squarely a problem of leadership. And that once you have a selfless leadership, everything will fall into line.
Mm. Well, that may be true. Okay. In fact, that is true. See, the problem for me is that we have identified this nearly 40 years ago. Okay. And today is still haunting us. I mean, so what will happen for us to actually take action of something we have identified 40 years ago? I mean, that's the question.
Okay, you're saying what will happen, that if we have identified the problem of leadership, sir?
Yes. Yes.
So what do we do to...
So when are we going to take action on it?
Now comes the issue of the Nigerian democracy. I'm happy that you're linking this issue. See, as I said, a peripheral capitalist country will have a democracy that is not rooted in the populace, so to say. Now, what you're having in Nigeria is a pseudo democracy. Now, are the leaders actually wanting power for the purpose of
governance,
ensuring the development of the country? Do they want power for the purpose of modernizing the country? No. It's simply about, you see, the struggle for power in Nigeria is about the need to capture power and exercise and use it for the purpose of wealth acquisition. So you actually find a situation where you see all the noise making, everybody is jostling, parties and all that, seeking power, but for what end? So first, for there to be a change, like you said, after having identified the problem of leadership, now there must be a question of reorientation. There is no two ways about it. The society must be reoriented away from the present crass materialism that has bedeviled the entire society. Otherwise, what you have is still the same, a kind of vicious cycle of rulers coming, acquiring wealth, another set comes, acquires wealth. So you actually find this, you actually have a situation where one set wants to outdo the other in terms of wealth acquisition. And that is what plays out. Mm. But now you ask, how does that, who will now bring about that reorientation? Who is going to spearhead it?
Yeah.
That is where the problem of military regime came in those days. You can't talk about Nigerian leadership without talking about the military regime.
Yeah.
The military, and not even Nigeria, the whole of Africa. The military betrayed Africans. Africans thought that the military, with their autocratic nature, could spoil Nigerian development much more easily than the politicians who were attuned to bickering infighting.
Hold on. See, this is where I say we didn't gain anything from history, okay? Because throughout history, the military has never done anything that is sustainable in terms of development. Even if you take it as far back to the Roman Empire, okay? At least I'm using the European history because we don't have the document or the history in Africa, okay? If we take it back to the Roman Empire, when the leaders were actually military generals from Caesar, okay? Mm-hmm. What did they do? They fought each other. All they did was fight each other.
Yes.
And in fact, that led to the downfall of Rome.
Yes.
That's okay. True. When the politicians, the other senators were struggling with each other, okay, they struggle and they compromise. They struggle, they compromise. That is politics. Okay. When a centurion that has a large army on his side is struggling with the next guy who has a large army on his side, what did they do? They fight.
Yes, that's true.
And what did they do? They destroyed the country. So, see, the military is not the answer to any governance issue.
Issue anywhere.
Anywhere.
Now, let me take you from there. That is because the military is not constituted, it's not trained to rule. The military has never been trained to rule. They are trained to defend the territorial integrity of any entity,
nation,
any nation. So when the military now begins to assume the role of arbiter, then there is bound to be a problem.
Yeah,
this also happened in Nigeria, where you had each ethnic group, the feuding ethnic groups, especially the three dominant ones, Igbo, Yoruba, and Hausa, were now jostling with one another, each trying to enlist the support of the military.
Yeah,
and that's what led to the Nigerian Civil War, the Hausa, some people call it the ruling Hausa oligarchy, triumphing over the Biafran secessionists. And that problem still lingers today. The Igbos still think that they have been marginalized and all that. And of recent, you have been having these drum beats of wars and all that. So the military, as it were supposed to, people thought that the military being in power would speed up Nigeria's euro, but we've now realized that the contrary is the case. They are there, as we've seen. All they do is loot.
Yeah.
And by the nature of their autocracy, their tyranny, you cannot even question them. This was the things that Fela was talking about. You see, I can't talk about Nigerian without talking about Fela. Fela was one of the very few people who understood the issue of military interventionism in African politics.
Yeah.
When Fela talks about soldier go, soldier come. And when soldiers were coming, what were they doing? They would give themselves one fanciful name.
Yeah.
Revolutionary Council, Armed Forces Ruling Council, Armed Forces Liberation Council, Revolutionary Committee of the People. You know, fanciful name that went dear themselves to the people. But it was all for nothing.
So let's take that to what is going on in Mali right now. Okay. And I think Sudan. Okay.
Mali, now, Sudan, Chad, and Guinea.
So the point is this. The military is not Africa's friend. Okay. Even though we say our politician right now is not our friend. Okay. But then for me, it's better for us to have the politicians who we will vote out the next election, okay, than the military that come and they go when they decide to go.
And the best military regime,
yeah,
is actually worse than the worst politician.
Yeah.
See, look at it this way. A military regime, by its nature, is an autocracy.
Mm.
A military regime comes to power. Look at it. What legitimizes a military regime is the success of the coup.
Yeah.
If the coup fails, it's treason, it's a treasonable offense and it'll be executed. So the military regime is, by its nature, an aberration and illegality. Yeah. What legitimizes it is the success of the coup. If the coup fails, they are liable to execution.
Mm.
So what do you expect them to do having captured power?
Yeah.
So the only thing that keeps the military in power is the force of arms. It's like an armed robber. An armed robber is able to subdue the victim because he's armed. Otherwise, the only reason why military people are able to take over power, it's because they are armed with a professional group like the doctors say they want to take over power.
Mm.
With a professional group like teachers say they want to take over power. No. But the military, as a professional group, is able to take over power because they are armed.
Yeah.
Arms is the only thing that legitimizes their rule.
Mm.
So what do you expect?
Mm. Well, see, we can talk about Nigerian history and Nigeria under development from today to next year. We will always have something to talk about. See, I was born in the 70s. Okay. And I became an adult in the 90s. Now, I see my generation as failures in terms of contributing something important to Nigeria and maybe the rest of Africa. Because, see, I look at it this way, that, okay, the people who won our independence, they didn't have that many millions of graduates, okay, to go into the professions. But by the time people like me were of age, there were hundreds of thousands of graduates. And yet, I don't know how many of us actually contributed something special to Nigeria development. All of us came out from school. We want to work in a bank. You want to work in an oil company. We go there, they pay us a lot of money, and we start jollofing.
You see, the foundation, it still boils down to what we were discussing earlier about the advent of post-colonial rule. Do you understand? Mm-hmm. Where you had the set of people that took over from the colonial masters.
Yeah.
They laid a terrible foundation. Yes, they fought against colonial rule and they succeeded in wresting colonial power from the colonialists. But what were they after? They were simply after replacing the colonial masters in terms of what
the elites.
In terms of perks of office and spoils of office.
Mm.
Now, look at it this way. You had the likes of Abubakar Tafawa Balewa and Ahmadu Bello. You had Zik, you had Awo. Now, the inter-ethnic struggle between them to acquire power at the center was what derailed the First Republic.
Yeah.
So, the generation that came after, of course, had learned from them. And don't forget that the military did not allow democracy to be rooted in Africa. All the military coups that occurred in Africa, most of them occurred in the 60s.
Yeah, from the 60s, 70s, 80s.
Right, as early as 1963, Eyadema had overthrown the Togolese government of Sylvanus Olympio. As early as 1965, Mobutu Sese Seko had overthrown the government of 1960, Congo is in turmoil today due to Mobutu's activities. What about Central Africa, where you have Emperor Bokassa?
Mm.
Bokassa, a military man, turned himself into an emperor. So it's just all these things you are seeing that you're saying the generation learned from what it saw.
Yeah.
On ground, there was no concrete plan. There was no concrete orientation of the citizenry towards imbibing those nationalist and patriotic sentiments. It was every man for himself. So the people imbibe what they saw. And that is what I'm saying, that for there to be a change, there must be a mass reorientation of the people. Now, let me give you one instance. This man, Buhari, in fairness to him, when he came in as a military man in 1983, he tried himself and his deputy, Brigadier Tunde Diagon. They tried a reorientation of the Nigerian side. They tried to reorient the masses.
War.
You see,
war
against the discipline. You could see it. People were beginning to align.
Align,
you
yes.
People queuing automatically. You can see people. You don't see anybody.
But then you see how quickly that orientation disappeared when he wasn't in power shows that it wasn't sustainable. Okay, now that's what happens when people are being forced to do something.
Mm.
Okay, see. Okay. In Europe, for example, nobody force you to do anything, but you are taught why you need to do it this way from school.
Okay.
They teach you through the history of their country where we are coming from. This is where we were maybe 200-300 years to 300 years ago, and this person did this, this person did this, and then we gradually came to this place. So we don't want to go back here. To make sure we don't go back there, then we need to continue the progress. And now it's your turn to add value to make sure we continue to go. Now, tell me, is our Nigerian students, being educated and taught the history, all the things that we have gone through. For me, okay, I wasn't a history student, but I thought that at least all of us should learn national ethics and history. See, I hear now that the teaching of history is not being done in Nigeria.
Yes, in secondary school, there's no
history. I mean, so history is no longer so where are we going?
Now that's the point. The point you are saying making is there's no civic culture.
Yeah.
Now Nigeria needs, okay, you were talking about Europe, how people do things voluntarily and all that. Europe and the advanced Western countries also to say the civilized world. But you see, that is the point. There must be a development of a civic culture whereby people learn the values, societal values of honesty, integrity. Yeah.
And all of those things are rooted in history.
They must be rooted in the democratic culture.
Yeah.
Now, and how does that democratic culture come? From a historical perspective, people must begin to learn where they are coming from.
Yeah.
And why they are where they are.
Yeah.
If you don't have that, you are groping in the dark. People will be doing things. Little children coming up will not know why they are even asked to do something. You know, now a little child, let me say, a little child, apart from being told that Nigerian independence was on 1st October 1960, he doesn't even know why there was independence. Because he doesn't know anything about colonial rule.
Yeah.
He doesn't know how colonialism came about and why the fight for colonialism. He doesn't know about anything about apartheid and the liberation struggle in Africa.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have that consciousness. So when you're even talking about the same democracy, he doesn't understand what it is for you to have periodic elections and why you need to forestall the occurrence of a dictatorship. He doesn't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
So when he's given a gun to go and terrorize a political opponent, he goes, because he cannot relate to why he shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
So those are part of the development of the civic culture, which comes about as a result of proper education. And that education includes the teaching of history, which we have determined is no longer necessary in Nigeria.
Who did that? Who came to that conclusion?
Well, you have the Ministry of Education who must have taught that science. You know, everybody now talks about science, technology.
So, see,
when you hear somebody mouthing empty phrases about science.
Let me say this. Yeah? See, I'm proud that I study science. Okay, and none of my mentors. Okay, the people I look up to. I have never worked as a scientist, but I love science so much. I read science a lot. I have so many books on science, especially consciousness. That's one thing I read a lot. And I watch a lot of science documentaries.
Mm-hmm.
One thing about scientists, they love history. When I say love history, they love history. So, so nobody can tell me just because we are wanting our youth to imbibe science, then we need to eliminate history. No!
That's the point. Because science, like you said, I personally, I take my time to read a lot of scientific development. Like I go into even esoteric scientific phenomena like time. Okay, there's this, remember this guy in the UK? This guy that had this is amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Steve Hawking. I go into esoteric terms like space exploration. And this thing thrill me.
Yeah.
And I think if there's anything I tell people is that if this world was made up of people like me, then we would still be living in the days of Masamasa. Because I don't have a foggiest idea about those things, you know. So I enjoy reading them. But even at that, we should not detract from the value of subjects like history.
History, philosophy.
Philosophy. Those things are the things that actually build you as a human being.
Those things.
They are the things that build you as a human being. And without them, you are just a moving vehicle.
Yeah.
A scientific, let me use the term, a scientific vehicle. You
know? No, see, no one can actually say he's a scientist that doesn't understand history. Okay. Now, I will say this. I'm sure many of my listeners might argue this, but then I want them to take note. Technology is not science. Okay? Technology is not science. Technology is using the knowledge of science to build things. Okay? But technology is not science. Okay? So many people who build things that people admire are not scientists, okay? Doctors are not scientists, okay? In fact,
they are like what you say mechanics of science.
Exactly.
The mechanics of science.
They are maximum 2% of doctors who are scientists because they do research, okay? They do experimentation. Other doctors do not. They just use the knowledge that scientists have discovered to perform their jobs, okay? So, but scientists.
Yeah, you see, that's why you have the Nobel Prize.
Yes.
The Nobel Prize. You actually see most of the Nobel laureates are people who were engaged in the theoretical aspect of science and technology, not the people who actually applied.
Yeah.
When you see you don't really have a Nobel Prize for something like you say Nobel Prize for
engineering. No.
Engineering, no.
Yeah. There is one about in medicine, but it's not about applying whatever.
But that's why you have
it's about Nobel discovery.
Prize for physics. For physics,
of course.
You have Nobel Prize for physiology, which they say is medicine.
Exactly.
So they're actually looking at the people who will do the underlying
physiology. Work. Physiology is science.
Yes.
Okay.
Medicine is the application of that.
Exactly.
So you see this thing. Exactly. So they're looking for people who will do the underlying work, So, but we, for some reasons, I don't know. But you see, science is good to build a scientific base for upcoming children and all that. But alongside, like we're saying, it must be accompanied with basic idea about values.
Yeah.
Societal values. So that they don't just become empty vessels who parrot phrases that they don't even know anything about.
No, see, and that's what a lot of our youths do because I engage a lot of young Africans on social media, and they say things. What I normally do is ask questions, and asking questions. I'm not telling you one thing or the other, but I'm asking you questions based on what you are saying. And most of the time I find out that they don't know much about what they are shouting from the top of the roof, you know, and it's disheartening, you know, because for me, in fact, I say this, social media has made a lot of people superstars, because you post something and people like, people comment, and when you post things that are not true factually, and a million people like it, that only shows that a million people are like you. Okay? That's it. They're like you. And for me, when I see those things, I get scared for Africa. Okay? Because most of the people who comment do not ask any question.
No, they don't.
And it scares me.
They don't. Why? Because it's like you're reinforcing their untaught opinion. You are reinforcing their poorly held
opinion. Yeah.
You know. So, you know, there's a social media, as the world is beginning to find out, it's actually an avenue for misinformation and disinformation.
Yeah. And promoting ignorance,
conspiracy theories,
and mediocrity.
Definitely, when you have a medium where you can propagate lies, I know lies actually move much faster.
Oh yeah,
that's the truth.
Oh yeah.
Let me give you an instance about this ongoing Ukraine crisis. Somebody posted on social media that there's a weapon that can destroy the world, that can destroy the entire world. Everybody went wild. And before you knew what was happening, I said, "But how come nobody's asking? Why would somebody produce a weapon that would destroy himself, that would destroy the target and the source? Is it a suicide weapon?" You know? You know, so that's just to give you a sense of what social media is now. People, the things they want to hear, once you propagate those things they want to hear, self-reinforcing information, whether it's true or not,
they
go with it. People, just like the most people don't read.
Yeah.
Most people don't bother to read. Write anything, you know, you write something more than a page, and people don't want to read it.
Yep.
If it is not a self-serving two-liner, where you are hailing them or yourself, nobody
wants to. Yes. See, you just touched on two very important things. Let me dig deeper into them. One is people who don't want to read. Let me correct it. Many Africans. Well, it's generally many people don't want to read, okay? But for me, what interests me is Africans, because the other people, their countries are doing better, okay? We don't read. And for me, yes, the people, the lower was it? the middle class of Africans, I'm a little bit disappointed because they after they go to university and they finish, it's as if they left the books locked up in the bookshelf. Yeah. You see, when this Russia-Ukraine
things started. I'm in several forums on WhatsApp, and people were posting things, you know, all over, the same thing that they saw on maybe Facebook or whatever, you know. So when the crisis started, people were posting so many things, you know, and as usual, I ask a lot of questions, and unfortunately, many people cannot discuss things based on facts, evidence, you know, true time, you know, or the history of Europe, Russia, Kiev. They don't know those things, okay? Yeah. But then they want to see themselves as knowledgeable. You see, it pains me when we don't realize, okay, I don't know much about this. So let me just sit down, listen to those people who seem to know, okay? You're not sure they know, okay? But then you just sit back and listen to them and ask questions.
You know,
we don't have that habit of sitting back and asking questions. See, we don't need to know everything.
Definitely.
Okay? But the ability to ask questions, to know, is important.
That boils down to what you were saying earlier, that half-truths are more dangerous than
than
lies. Half-truths are more dangerous than lies.
You see, I'll say this. Many of my listeners will be angry about this. But yes, what Russia is saying, some of them are true, but some of them are false. Okay? That's based on what I know of European history. You know, I know a little bit, okay?
Okay.
Some of them are true, some of them are false. But see, for me, I'm not against Russia. I'm not pro Ukraine. But see, the truth for me, I understand why Europe is so scared about this conflict. Okay? It's bringing back what they were hoping to eliminate in Europe.
Okay. Yes.
Okay. That
authority. Let me take it from here.
Yeah. Okay.
Put it simply like this. It's like somebody is bringing back Europe of the 18th and 19th century.
Yeah. Exactly.
That is exactly what it is.
Yeah.
See, mm-hmm. Now, look, I have personally written 3 articles about this Ukraine crisis.
Okay.
The first one was the first one titled Ukraine. Conflict is not, sorry, war is not inevitable if diplomacy is on the cards.
Okay.
There, in that particular article, I argued that Putin has a point in terms of his geopolitical interest, in terms of vis-a-vis NATO. In terms of the fact that NATO's expansionism may be a threat to him, to Russia. I definitely agree with him. But I did argue that what he just wants to do was to draw attention to that fact by massing troops on Ukraine. But of course, he was denying that he was going to invade and lying rampantly that he was going to invade and all that. And everybody took his word for it. To the extent that even when Biden kept saying that he would invade, people were now beginning to say, no, this American president.
Yes, are you a war monger? Yeah.
Thank you. He's trying to put words into that. But what happened? He actually invaded against.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is, so he actually went and invaded
Ukraine,
the country against expectations.
Mm.
So what does that tell you? Why not exhaust all diplomacy?
Yeah.
Now, but see, people are carried away by his cheap propaganda, infantile propaganda that a little child will not believe. Now, they're forgetting that, you know, they say fools have short memory and dunces have none. They're forgetting that this man for 4 months, between October 2021 and February 24th, when he invaded, February 24th, 2020, when he invaded, that he denied that he was never going to invade.
Exactly. Nobody is talking about that.
Nobody's talking about that again. His foreign minister lied blatantly that if it is for Russia, there will never be war. Where is he? He's still the one negotiating. So who will believe him? So when you see these things, you now realize that, you know, let me put it again. I've written a second article where I now likened Putin to his warmongering to that of American presidents like George Bush Jr. and Senior, and of course Ronald Reagan. Okay, that's that bellicosity, that belligerency to use military might and all that.
Yeah.
But those ones, when you compare them to him, are even more humane, because America, when they invaded Grenada, they didn't destroy Grenada. When Bush invaded Iraq, he didn't destroy Iraq. Most of the fights they had in Iraq, like Fallujah and the rest of them, America was fighting door to door. They were not bombarding. But this man, you know, has a militarist, how do I say, a barbaric militarist tendency of using firepower to overwhelm the enemy. He did it in Syria. He reduced arms, Aleppo, to rubble. He did it in Grozny when he tried to flush out the Muslim rebels of Chechnya, the Chechen rebels.
So
it's like he believes in military power.
Yeah.
He glorifies military power. And when you listen to his utterances, that is what you get, because he talks about using nuclear weapons, and that is what I don't understand.
Yeah.
He threatens nuclear war.
Exactly.
How? Why?
All the time.
All the time. So why? How? And he does it well. Maybe he thinks he has it. He does not have it. He knows too well that he doesn't have a monopoly of nuclear weapons. So how are you going to? Is it that when you now unleash a nuclear war, the other countries, US and its allies, will be looking at you with their own arsenal? So I'm worried about his mental. You know, people are beginning to talk about his mental health.
Yeah,
Putin's mental health.
Mm.
I too am concerned, because it doesn't seem, things don't seem right. Even in the days of the Soviet Union and the US, that Cold War period, when you had two ideologically opposed forces, nobody talked about nuclear war.
Yeah,
and even then
they were very reluctant to even mention it.
They hardly mention it.
Yeah,
they will go behind you. That's why you had all those strategic and limitation talks, strategic nuclear reduction talks, and all those things. They were very eager not to to ensure that. Okay, look at the Cuba missile crisis.
Yeah,
as close as they were, they ensured that behind the scene negotiations were going on.
Mm-hmm.
They were using, Kennedy was using his own brother.
Yeah.
That is bypassing the official channel.
Send
messages to the Soviet Union. And at the end of the day, they resolved it diplomatically.
Yeah.
For this one, you know, mass troops on the border, for 4 months, you were actually preparing the invasion of another country. Macron went to greet him, to meet him. Who again? Several heads of state.
Yeah, the new German chancellor went.
Mm-hmm. And he will promise them that there will be no war. So what do you make of that human being? And people are saying that he was facing an existential threat. And the question I ask, what is existential?
Exactly. Threat? That's if the question I ask. That's the question I ask too.
Okay. If there was no existential threat between the US and the Soviet Union, when communism was faced with capitalism.
Yeah.
Now, why is there an existential threat? When Russia is even a capitalist country sharing values with the West?
Yeah.
Is the West going to attack Russia?
Yeah, exactly. Is NATO going to attack Russia? Are they going to do that? Okay. For that's the question.
So the question, so you just see a military power. You know, you see, there's something about what they call great power chauvinism, where a great power, a military power, now begins to exhibit that hubris of thinking that it can get away with anything it does. It happened with the US in Vietnam, and they paid dearly for it.
Yes, yes.
It happened with Soviet Union in Afghanistan. They paid dearly for it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it even happened with the US in Iraq again.
Yeah.
And they paid dearly for it.
Yeah.
So, why doesn't he think he will pay?
Well, in Ukraine? See, I don't know. A lot of young Africans, unfortunately, if you talk to them and ask a few questions, you find out that many of them are supporting, or I don't know if the word is supporting, but they are buy into Putin's rhetoric, propaganda, because according to them, Russia didn't colonize Africa, for one. And they didn't bomb Libya and kill Gaddafi. Okay. Unfortunately, whenever they tell me about Russia not colonizing Africa, it goes back to knowing history. Okay. The first European country that tried to colonize Africa was Russia.
You see, the fact is, they didn't have the wherewithal to engage in that scramble.
Exactly, that's it. The only reason why they were not involved is because they didn't have a way to come to Africa as often as the other Western European countries.
If they had the wherewithal, they would. If Portugal, Spain, Italy could get involved, Russia would also have gotten what they did. Russia would. People have forgotten that.
No, see, their geography didn't allow them, and then to come through the Black Sea and the Mediterranean.
It would have taken a long detour. But even beyond that, Russia was not having the might. They were not. People have forgotten that until 1917, before the Bolshevik Revolution, Russia was a feudal country. Russia was not even a capitalist country.
They don't know all this.
Fine. So it isn't a capitalist country having the wherewithal to compete with the likes of Britain, France.
Even today, the majority of Russians are far, far behind the poorest people in Western Europe. That's even today.
Yes, that's true.
See,
and you see, that is why I pity them now. That is why I pity the ordinary citizens of Russia.
Yeah.
You see, people used to get, I used to like Putin. I used to like, you know, when you read the speeches, much of what you hear is modernization and development. He talks about those phenomena. Often, development, modernization. Now, but with what he has done, this event has kind of diminished him. So all those talk about modernizing the Russian economy and all that are now to the dogs. Because why? See, he has just beaten more than he can chew. Russian economy is not as large as economy.
It's less than the economy of Texas.
So how are they going to
the US?
So in the long run, in the short run, they will be able to manage. But in the long run, if these sanctions being imposed on them, left, right, and center, begin to take effect, in the long run, how are they going to?
Well, they are hoping that China will bail them out. But
Russia is not a mass exporting country. What do they export? Oil and gas.
Oil and gas. That's it.
And once they choke them off that oil and gas, they are done for. People know. See, That's why when you hear Biden shaking his head, when you see Biden shaking his head and saying Russia will pay every price, he knows what he's talking about. Russia cannot withstand what is coming. They cannot. And the end, you see, that's what, now you're going to see the ego of a leader coming into play.
Yeah.
He doesn't, even if he wanted to withdraw, he doesn't know
how to do it.
Well, he has invested his ego.
Well, like you say, we should feel sorry for the ordinary Russian citizens. Now, people are being put in jail for just talking about what they are doing, what Russia is doing. Okay, factually, okay, their invasion. Okay, people are being put in jail. People can't express. See, this is one of the things that young Africans don't understand. See, yes, our economy in Africa is still backward. That's what. But if there's something we have gained, not fully, from Western Europe, is the ability to have some say, okay, in our country and about our government, okay? Now,
democracy.
Yeah, we at least we have more freedom to criticize our government. The things that Nigerians in particular say about our current government, Russians cannot try it.
Thank you very much. Now you've raised a very vital point. You see, democracy, there's no alternative to it. See, Nigerians don't know what they enjoy in terms of freedom of expression.
Yeah.
You see, forget the fact that there's a culture of impunity. You may criticize, you may do all this, people may steal, but that freedom of expression, Nigerians enjoy it.
They don't know how the Europeans had to fight to get it.
Yes, to get to the level they are.
Yeah.
So more than any other country in Africa, Nigerians enjoy freedom of expression.
Yes.
Now look at that is the difference between a democracy and an autocracy, which Russia. Now you look at the war, you cannot even refer to the Ukraine war as a war. Russia.
Yeah.
As a war in Russia, they say it's a special operation.
Yes.
So they've criminalized it. they've criminalized it. When you call it a war,
you go to jail.
You go to jail. So just imagine that kind of thing. So it tells you the level of dictatorship Putin has fostered on that society.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is the difference. If it were, that is the difference between a democracy and a dictatorship.
Yeah.
You can actually, like Nigerians, we make so much noise and all that. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, the government may listen.
Not only do we make noise, we write articles. Yeah?
And ensure that those articles stay there. Nobody will remove them from the internet.
So
whereas in Russia now, you cannot even write an article criticizing the war.
Who are you?
So that tells you the difference between a democracy. Nigeria may be a pseudo democracy, but there's a marked difference between a democracy and a dictatorship that we have in Russia.
Yeah.
And so, those are the same things
that
is leading, that is behind this war in reality. Because people say Putin, to a large extent, wants to cow the domestic opposition, which is already doing anything.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Look at this man, Navalny.
Yeah.
Alexei Navalny.
Mm-hmm.
As the crisis is going on in Ukraine, they revised his jail term and not jailed him for, is it 13 more years?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So when the leader begins to jail the opposition, begins to assassinate the opposition, members of the opposition, either you're assassinating them or you are jailing them. What kind of leadership is that?
Wow.
At least we don't have that in Nigeria. At least to some extent, we don't have the head of state jailing his opponents. Do we have?
No.
We don't have the head of state jailing his or assassinating his opponent. Mm-hmm. At least we don't have.
Well, no, we don't. You know, we don't.
We have issues of terrorism. We have issues of banditry, but it hasn't reached a stage where the head of state directly assassinates his opponent.
Yeah. You know? So these things we need to. Young Africans need to understand all these things, and because if we don't understand these things, they won't fight to keep them. You see, if we don't understand the difference, will not fight to keep them. And the truth of the matter is that people need to fight to keep the gains that their societies have gained. You know, if you don't fight for it, you lose it very easily, very easily.
That is why this. When you talk about fighting for democracy, like you have this upcoming election now.
Yes.
Because the critical issue is this upcoming 2023 election. You know, it's a crucial election in the sense that the issues roiling Nigeria now, the issues of insecurity.
Yes.
Insecurity has become the number one issue in Nigeria.
Oh, it is.
Because you cannot move across Nigeria. Now, gone are the days when you say, I'm leaving Lagos for Benin, and you set off in the evening and you say, well, I'll get there in the night. No, forget it.
You see, my in the 90s and the early 21st century, my father used to work for NNPC, okay? And he travels all across the country. He goes to Kaduna very frequently. Today, unfortunately, I know somebody who was adopted in that train.
That train attack.
Yes.
Okay,
yeah. And she's still with them.
Okay, till now, and has been released. Maybe they're asking for a ransom.
And unfortunately, no action is being taken. No communication. Nothing.
So insecurity is number one problem now. And that is, those are the issues in this upcoming election, insecurity. Then, of course, the number one problem in Nigeria used to be energy crisis, the problem of electricity. That one now has taken a secondary issue to insecurity now. So you actually find everybody is looking up to a candidate, is looking up to an aspirant that has those issues that want to address those issues, but the candidates coming up are not exciting. There are people that you have seen and you don't think that they are capable, so you've seen them.
So
either think, as governors, either as senators,
our landlord in Lagos, our landlord is contesting. What do you think about our landlord? Our number one landlord in Lagos.
No. You know, you see, now look at.
Do you know who I'm talking about?
You are talking about Jacobin.
Good. He's a landlord, yeah.
You know, look at it. You see, the issue of people like that, Tinubu, the likes of Tinubu, the likes of Peter Obi, the likes of Abubakar
Atiku
contesting the election. In Nigeria, is about the issue of financing electioneering campaign. Now, look at it this way. You know, democracy, global democracy, is in somewhat of a crisis because of the issue of financing of campaign.
Yeah.
Even in the US, you see the problem.
Oh, yeah.
There. You see the problem in the US where the corporate bodies have now hijacked the process of election financing and all that. So in Nigeria, it's even worse in a country like Nigeria because you cannot finance an election in Nigeria if you are not a multi-millionaire. Also, say if you are not a billionaire. Even a local government election to finance it in Nigeria is you're talking of millions of.
So we need election finance
reform.
Reform. Yeah.
Fine. That is the first. Without that, what you have are money bags.
Yes.
Money bags coming up and hijacking the process.
Yes. And once they invest in a candidate,
it's an investment.
Yes.
It's an investment. They must recoup.
So they need to get
they must
back.
Recoup that investment.
Okay.
So who are the guys coming up? So the bad guys, a good guy will not have the means Why? Because he wouldn't even want to gamble with his money.
Yeah.
A good guy does not even have the money. Let's put it that way. And even if he has the money, he won't want to gamble with it. If he loses, yeah. what happens to him?
Yeah.
So you find the bad guys that have the money, of course, got it through some questionable means. So they can afford to throw it away.
Well,
so it's a vicious cycle. The bad guy comes,
the truth of the matter is that they are not throwing it away. They somehow know they will recoup it, even if they lose the election. Because whoever wins the election will want to get them on board, and then they'll give them
Even if the bad guy loses the election, he has a way of recouping because first of all, he goes back to the source of the money.
Yeah.
He goes back to the source of the one he threw in. So it's a vicious cycle. So what the point is, there must be election financing reform.
Reforms, yeah.
People have tried it all across the world. You know, this guy, what was it? Muammar Gaddafi tried it in Libya. But you see, Gaddafi was a joke. Gaddafi, in trying to eliminate the issue of representation based on money on the election financing, instituted a lot of bodies, Al Jamaira People's Congress, Jamaira Local Congress. But at the end of the day, he came back to square one. He himself was there. So who was replacing him?
Oh.
He was there for 42 years. So you know.
You said Gaddafi was in power for 42 years.
Yes.
We have so many African leaders who have been in power for decades.
Yes. The longest of them is still there. Obiang Nguema Basogo of Equatorial Guinea. He has just surpassed Gaddafi's 42 years now. I think he will go into 44 now. 44.
I mean, so see, these things, I'm highlighting these things because I want my listeners, my young listeners, to understand that these are the issues. You may think they are small, but these are the issues that are holding Africa back.
Definitely.
See, the same person in power for decades, yet his country has not moved one step.
Yes. Look,
and yet he's in power.
And does not want to leave.
And he doesn't want to go.
He doesn't want to go. Look, Mbasogo, don't forget, was a military man.
Yeah, of course.
Mbasogo overthrew his uncle, Obiang, who was a madman, in 1979. And the country has a lot of oil, a very small country that should be enjoying abundant oil wealth. But what do they have? Poverty. Mbasogo and his son. Once in a while, he projects his son as if he wants to hand over to.
it's a monarchy.
Like you have in Togo, where Eyadema manipulated his son into position, and or in Gabon, where Bongo manipulated his son into power too. So you have situations like that, and those are the things Africans. We must first of all tackle.
Yeah.
Sit tight presidency.
Yeah.
To a large extent, Nigeria, we've not really had it. So only Abacha that was a general Abacha that was trying to bring
do the same. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If he had succeeded, maybe by now we'll be talking about how his son will succeed.
Wow. See, Dennis, this conversation has been very, very interesting. See, unfortunately, we need to end it here.
Yes,
right. I'm very grateful for you coming on board, right? So, my guys, my friend Dennis Onakino has been with us for the last maybe 90 minutes. Wow, more. Yeah, yeah. So, Dennis, thank you very much for.
Yeah, thank you. You know, we can talk about these issues for our definition. We can talk about them for the rest of the day and continue to do.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Especially when it comes to issues of African leadership,
yeah,
the leadership conundrum and all that is,
yeah,
is so interesting and riveting. So it's not something you start and want to run away from. it kind of enraptures you. You get sucked into it.
Yes. Yes. Mm. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Bye.
Take care.
Listen or watch more episodes of Think Big for Africa podcast with new guests every week. Subscribe to ensure that you are notified whenever new episodes are available.